This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Today's show is brought to you by GoDaddy.com. Visit GoDaddy.com and enter promo code Gilbert149 to get your $1.49.com today. GoDaddy, it's go time. Movie Big Eyes, directed by Tim Burton and starring Amy Adams and Christoph Waltz, opens on Christmas Day. They're also our only guests to own a Willie Tyler and Lester dummy. Welcome, Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski.
Woo! Thank you.
Good to see you, Gilbert.
Hi. Well, I don't really...
What
have you
been doing for 20 years since we last saw you on Problem Child 2?
No, we saw him on Problem Child 3.
Oh, that's correct.
And, yes. and the cartoon show.
Oh, now, but you never worked on 3.
We supervised it.
You did?
We watched it from a distance.
No one ever saw that movie.
It was the lowest rated TV movie for NBC that entire season. They had a free rerun in their contract, and they chose not to use it.
Yep.
That starred Greatest American Hero. Yeah,
William Katt.
Yes.
William Katt.
What was it like working with him?
He was happy.
And a different junior.
Yes. I don't know whatever happened to him.
That's a great question.
Which
to the replacement junior.
Now here's something I really want to talk about. Fuck your new movie. What I want to talk about.
Let's talk about Junior for an hour.
Okay. Yes. I emailed Junior, the problem child from the Problem Child Pictures.
I know. I gave you his email. Yes.
Yes, and he never emailed me back, which is the lowest insult you could get in this business when
Junior won't return your
call. Yes. Yeah.
Wow, that's a...
This is Gilbert again. Maybe you didn't get the message. Please.
Yeah, I'm not sure your answering machine was working.
I'm in town just for a little bit.
Yeah.
So maybe we can get together.
That'd be fun. Old times.
Didn't you ask him to do the podcast, too? Or
yes,
your intention?
Yes, that was my intention. And I don't know why he never answered. It can't be because he's busy.
Maybe you weren't paying him enough.
Exactly.
Yes.
Bad memories. How about that?
Now, what I remember about Problem Child, what got you to write? Well, you originally wrote Problem Child as like a really dark comedy.
That's correct.
Yes. Very good. Yeah, we read a newspaper article. Believe it or not, Problem Child is kind of based on a newspaper article. We read a newspaper
like
article
everything else.
About a couple that were suing an adoption agency.
This is in Orange County, California.
Yeah, they adopted this kid, and they took him home, and he was like started writing his name and shit on the walls, and he tried to burn down their house, and they like really turned their life horrible. And then they found out the kid had been adopted like 15 times, and every time he just like he was like a crazy person, so, and the adaptation agency knew it, and then so, and that was basically your character.
And then the parents actually had to go on the run,
yes,
and like have their names changed because the kid was trying to find them.
It was
an insane story. A lot of people. The story was in the LA Times, and a lot of bottom feeder writers and producers like us saw this story. Everybody in town started to pitch it as a horror film. We were the only guys in town trying to pitch it as a comedy.
Right.
So we kind of broke through the clutter. So we sold it as a comedy pitch.
Yeah, everyone thought it was like a bad seed kind of movie. And we were like, yeah, it's a bad seed kind of movie, but it'd be funny.
Didn't I read you guys were trying to do something, get away from movies like Baby Boom and Three Men and a Baby?
Very good. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, wow, you've done your homework.
There was a bit of a genre at the time, kind of like, you know, how babies can change a yuppie's life.
She's having a baby.
We just care about money and work in the late 80s.
Kindergarten Cop can change a tough cop.
But there are all these movies were about how cute little kids are. And it was this very profitable genre, so we thought it could sort of be a counter answer to that.
Right.
Saying, well, what if kids aren't all great?
It was.
Now I can brag that Problem Child was based on a true story.
It would be funnier if it had that credit in the beginning of the movie.
And I remember, too, Universal, at the time, I remember two quotes. One executive said, if this movie even breaks even, we'll be dancing in the streets. And another Universal exec said, we're going to treat this movie like a wounded soldier on the battlefield, and we're all going to run and save our own asses.
Oh, wow.
Okay, I remember a few quotes. Everyone was very embarrassed by it because it was a pretty shameful production. We reshot that movie about 11 times just so the shots would cut together. After the movie came out, Tom Pollock, chairman of Universal, to his credit, said it was their most profitable film of 1990, which we felt very good about. It was so profitable, yet they were still so embarrassed, that when we went to make Problem Child 2, the head of physical production, I won't name her, but she tried to budget the film to shoot in 16mm.
Yeah.
She didn't even want us to shoot in 35 because what's the difference? The audience of Problem Child 2 isn't going to know.
Right. I remember one like box office analysis at the end of the year because it came out the same year as Home Alone. And they said Problem Child was more influential than Home Alone because Problem Child proved that it didn't have to be good.
I remember when it was my last day of shooting there, I was saying goodbye to John Ritter. And he was basically there with that look on his face, like, and he was saying, well, you know the way it is in the business, you do something and that's all you can do. You go on to the next thing and
but when he died, the Academy Awards, the in memorandum thing, it was him falling down from Problem Child.
Do I have this right? Was it Scott that cried at one of the screenings?
I cried at the cast and crew screening. It was our first movie, and it was so terrible, and I was so sad.
Sorry to bring up.
But what's really weird now, though, is
people they call it a classic, right. Which is really misusing the word.
Oh yes,
but it's been so long. I mean, maybe God bless Ted Turner and TBS. That movie has been run into the ground, and so many kids now for 20 years have grown up watching that movie. It is beloved,
right?
And so I guess my opinion of it has come around that it's still a mess, but it's out of its mind. And there are very few kids' movies that are just that black and that crazy. And so it gets points for that.
What's funny is that...
And
that,
it's funny.
Yeah, it's actually funny. And the for a long time, I wouldn't say we left it off our resume, but we wouldn't like to talk about it. We wouldn't lead with Problem Child. And nowadays, we go to meetings with executives... And they were 10 years when it came. They were 10 years old when it came out. So for them, they're like, "Oh my God, problems! You guys are the guys who wrote Problem Child."
See, every day I have people come over to me that say they love the Problem Child movies, and it is kind of a sick, deranged movie when you really look at it. And that John Ritter's wife starts fucking an escaped convict.
An escaped serial killer.
A serial
Michael
killer.
Richard's character?
Yes.
Yeah. She's having sex with a serial killer while her husband is catatonic.
And he takes a pillow.
And he goes to smother the
and wants to kill his own
child. This is a PG family film.
So it was pretty dark.
Yes. Well, actually, the sequel, when we first submitted it to the ratings board...
Oh, this was a closely held secret.
Yeah. Yeah.
actually, this might be the first place we've ever told this story. It got rated R.
And the studio went crazy.
We had what the hell did you do?
We had destroyed their family franchise.
How can Problem Child 2 be rated R?
We had jumped from PG, right past PG-13 to R.
We had to take out, I think Junior one time was yelling at Dad, like, Dad, you're pussy whipped. And taking out Pussy Whipped got it moved to PG-13. But they were still so nervous that parents wouldn't take their kids that they slapped a Woody Woodpecker.
The world's shittiest Woody Woodpecker cartoon.
They didn't give a shit.
Smoked hands.
Yeah, smoked hands. They just literally grabbed anything and threw it so it looked kind of cute.
I remember.
It was like draping tinsel over a crappy tree.
Yeah. One of my favorite censor jobs is when Problem Child 2 was on TV. There's one part where the women in the neighborhood are delivering pies.
Yes, Martha Quinn of MTV.
Yes, yes. And at one point, one of the women John Ritter wants to take out, and Junior says, oh, her pie gave us the runs. Right. So they don't want a diarrhea reference, so they cut it out and make it... Her pie gave us the rash. So they cleaned
it. Oh, dear. Wow. That's filthier.
Yes.
That's filthier.
They changed it from diarrhea to syphilis.
Wow. That's amazing.
So how did you get from Problem Child? You guys did not want to be known as the Problem Child.
I mean, just to blame ourselves a bit, because we got so beat up on the first Problem Child and we got fired repeatedly, when they brought us back for part two, they sort of had no choice because they had to do it really fast because Michael, the junior kid, was growing. And so they needed a script like just like in 8 weeks. And so we said, fine, you want bad taste, we're going to give you bad taste. And we had a little note up in our office, which no one ever saw, which was, we are making a Pasolini movie for children.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
And it's John Waters movie. It really was just one of these weird things where, I think because we just embraced it. So that second movie is insane with the vomit scene and the cockroach.
Oh, on the right.
Yeah. So the gigantic shit the dog takes.
Oh, yes, and the dog is paralyzed at one point.
We had a test screening with our, my beloved anecdote person, Tom Pollock, sitting in front of us, like in Pasadena at the test screening, and during the vomit, vomit's like all over the screen, and the audience is just howling. The audience is having a great time, and Tom Pollock, I remember, covered up his head and crawled under his chair. He was so mortified, sort of like, what have I wrought?
I remember the big discussion after the test screening was, were they laughing or were they moaning? We knew they were making noise, but we weren't sure whether it was pleasure.
Oh, and there's a quick reference that the ASPCA guys that helped the dog are gay.
Yes.
and then I was an adoption agency worker in the first movie, and I become principal of a school. Which, so I just assumed there was a part missing where there's a help wanted for principal, no experience necessary.
I will defend that one. Because we acknowledge it as a joke, which is in your opening... This is all we're going to talk about. Yes. In your opening scene, you're saying...
It doesn't say guys open Christmas Day. I think it does.
Thank God I got away from that bad town I lived in. Thank God I got out of that adoption agency racket. I fast-talked my way into a good new job in this new town. Everything's going to be fine. And then the door opens and there's Junior.
Right.
So at least it has the form of a joke. In part three, which we did not write, they just... Junior just like...
I was a dentist.
He has a toothache.
Yeah.
And he walks in your office and now you're a dentist. That doesn't make sense. How did Mr. Peabody go to medical school in between two and three? That's a sloppy.
I'll even defend that. That what Gilbert was in that movie was the utility player. He was the funny guy, like a 1930s.
But he's the same character.
He's the same character, but it was great. It was like whatever you needed that character to be.
Like Mr. Peabody. Exactly. Movie.
Exactly.
Just roll him out.
Mr. Peabody shows up.
Gilbert, do you remember on 1 and 2, you used to describe yourself as the cover set?
Yes.
The cover set?
The cover set. Right. Because all of your scenes were indoors.
Oh yes.
So you were the thankless cover set. You were just and we shot this movie in this strange empty futuristic city called Las Colinas, Texas. And they had built a monorail with only one person on the monorail, which was Gilbert Gottfried, riding around lonely for hours a day, waiting for someone to pull him up because he was the cover set. Well, he had nothing else to do.
That's how we became friends with you. And for people who are listening to this, a cover set is basically... When you're making a movie, there's usually like one actor you hire that stays there the entire time.
Because he's not in the important scenes.
He's not in the important scenes. So like if it rains, you can go like, we'll go shoot their scenes.
Oh, well.
That's why it's called a cover set. Gilbert was just hanging out in Texas with no purpose. He had like 3 scenes to shoot. And so every night he'd be like, oh, Gilbert wants to go to dinner. All right, well, let's go to dinner with Gilbert.
Gilbert wants to know if it's going to rain tomorrow. No, it's not.
I remember looking at, like, the sheets at the beginning of the day that give you the rundown. And it actually, it goes...
The rash down.
Yes. And it goes, you know, a John Ritter scene 5, 6, and 7, Amy Asbeck 7, 8, 9. And it says, it's true. It said, Gilbert Gottfried in case of rain. Which
I think that's the title of your autobiography.
Yes!
Fantastic autobiography.
Yeah. You know, and I'll praise Gilbert for all the reshooting that movie did. I don't think we ever had to reshoot one of your scenes because they were perfect the first time.
Yes.
See? Let's keep talking about me.
let's jump to Ed Wood since we're short on time and you guys.
Oh wow!
So you guys have a screening
okay,
window too.
Okay. Well,
you didn't want to be known as the problem child writer, so you decided to do something personal.
Well, right? We had written these problem child movies. They were hits, but the problem was we would go into like executive's office and pitch our new idea, and they'd be like, "Well, that's a great idea for a movie, but you guys wrote problem child," you know? And so. They wouldn't buy it from us, and so we felt really kind of crappy because we weren't sort of
people
like...
People get typecast pretty
exactly.
fast.
Exactly. And so we decided that even though, even though the movies were hits, maybe we started our career the wrong way. We should have written problem child movies. We should have, just done the whole, Sundance Film Festival game. So we were going to write, a small indie movie.
You know, this reminds me of a story, too, that Larry David... once wrote some special I was in, a terrible special called Norman's Corner.
Oh, yeah.
And when he was pitching Seinfeld, they were saying, didn't he write that piece of shit with Gilbert Gottfried?
Oh, no.
Is that you were the news handler?
You're responsible for a lot of people changing their careers.
Yes.
Fuck.
I could have stopped Seinfeld from getting on the air.
Wow.
So Ed Wood, you wrote it on spec.
We wrote it on spec. We managed to land on Tim Burton's desk, and Tim Burton decided to make it his movie, and it really sort of changed our lives in a big way.
And he shot your first draft.
He shot our first draft.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
And if I can get pretentious for a second or read into it, I kind of think there's a weird link between the problem child movies and the stuff you did afterwards.
Of course there is.
Because it was disrespected.
Yes.
But a big hit.
Yes.
And you guys were disrespected for creating it.
That is all true. Because when the problem child movies were so reviled, yet popular.
Yes.
It's like when you read enough of these bad reviews, you feel really sad. We had reviews saying, "Oh, this screenplay was finger painted.
Right.
It wasn't written." And we hadn't set out to make bad movies. It just happened. it's just tragedy.
That should be the name of my autobiography.
It just happened. We didn't set out to make bad movies.
you know,
I remember we were being in Problem Child 2 in Orlando, and we ran to a security guard, and he looked at you, and you were hosting those bad movie nights. Remember?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And he's like, I know you. You host that show, Sorry Movies That Suck.
Which would have been a much better title. But yeah, it's like, because I think like you go from Problem Child where you become like Ed Wood, like a disrespected, and Problem Child is kind of like those big eye paintings.
Yeah, sure,
that
sure.
Absolutely. The critics hated those. Everybody thought it was garbage, but it was incredibly popular.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was funny, yeah. It wasn't even, if it had not been a hit, we could have always distanced ourselves or whatever, but because it was a hit and it was terrible, it sort of just, it stuck on
us.
Yeah. But I think what Scott was about to say.
Yeah, you're talking about your
fuck him.
Your old show,
anyway.
Bad Movies That Suck.
Yeah.
Ed Wood was sort of famous as the crappy guy. And the Medved brothers had written the Golden Turkey Awards, and they had this traveling road show where they would go around to the revival houses, and they would show the Ed Wood triple feature, and then they would come out in between the movies and make fun of him. And I went to one of these shows when I was in high school. And so everybody was laughing at Ed. And so we started talking about Ed Wood and sort of saying, well, nobody feels sorry for him. Everyone is just making fun of him. And with the Problem Child experience we had gone through for a couple of years, we said, what if you made a movie about Ed, but you were totally sympathetic, and you're not going to make fun of him at all? Because he came out to Hollywood, and he wanted to be a director, and he directed 6 feature films. And that's more than most guys who come to Hollywood.
Right. Yeah.
So what if we just celebrate that, and we just say, hooray for Ed, and he gave hope and purpose to all his buddies, and he made his movies, and he put his vision on film, and yay.
Because, well, with both of your films, it's like what I've noticed with Ed Wood in particular. You know, you show the silliness and the amateurishness and the jokes, but you have a total sympathy
for
these people.
Right, and in the new one, too. I mean, I think what we learned from that was to take a very non-judgmental attitude towards the work, whether it's you know, Planet 9 from Outer Space or Hustler Magazine or the Keane paintings. It's like
you're interested in Characters on the Fringe.
Yeah, Characters on the Fringe, but also it's like the world has so judged these people and so looks down on these people that becomes kind of the plot of the movie. And so if we just stand back and just look at the art for what it is, you know, and let people make up their own minds.
I remember there was like back when they had record stores, they had some dingy little opera record store that had a sign in the window that said, we don't carry Pavarotti, check Tower Records.
Oh, wow.
Like, and everyone loved Pavarotti, but, you know, he's garbage. He's popular.
He's a hack.
Yeah.
Also, the other thing, though, I'll say about a lot of these characters is that once you know their personal story, you look at the art a little differently. Like Glenn or Glenda, in terms of Ed Wood, that was a real easy movie to laugh at. Oh, he's a transvestite, ah ha ha, he's doing all this. But once you know that was Ed playing that part, and once you know that Ed was actually like putting his personal story on film, it becomes much more of like a weird experimental movie. And the same thing with Margaret Keane's paintings. If you just look at those big eyed children, and they're done by Walter Keane, who's this masculine guy, this kind of Robert Mitchum guy. Why is he painting a picture of a crying child holding a cat? It makes no sense. Or if it's just in Woolworths and it's just a piece of anonymous art, it's kitsch. But once you know that the eyes are crying because the woman is locked up in the attic and they're coming from a sincere place, I think you're able to look at the art just a little bit differently.
And Ed Wood is such a personal story. I mean, it's such a far cry from something like Problem Child. Yeah. You're sitting down and you're thinking at any point, is a director going to be interested in this material? Is this only something that we care about? Did you have Tim Burton in mind at all?
No. I mean, we really were just sort of trying to get back to course correcting. Like Larry said, while going to college, I had crewed on a bunch of low-budget horror movies. So I had lived in that world. Mm-hmm. Of horror movie,
and you guys met at USC.
That's right, we're roommates.
Yeah, and so this idea of, I had sort of seen how people put together limited partnerships and they make little indie movies, and then we had our buddy Michael Lehman, whose first movie was Heathers.
Sure.
His second movie was Meet the Applegates, And then the third movie was Hudson Hawk.
Oh.
And Hudson Hawk was a big debacle for everyone. And Michael has a very good sense of humor. And we were talking about this Ed Wood project. And then we started joking about it with Michael, saying, well, maybe we should all do it together. If you get the writers of Problem Child and the director of Hudson Hawk making a movie about the worst filmmaker of all time, now you've got something.
Yeah. Yeah. They say, write what you know. Yeah. Write what you know.
And you know, and Michael had done Heathers, you know, on a very small budget. Mm-hmm. And we all said, you know, maybe this is the way to do this movie, is do it small. And then, like Larry's saying, and then we sort of got our outline to Tim. And we were really just hoping for Tim to say, Tim Burton Presents.
Uh-huh.
Which would help.
Because Michael Lehman was going to direct.
Yes. Right. Yeah. And Tim Burton Presents, and then we could go raise some money to go make an indie movie. But instead, Tim said, wow, is there a script? I think I'd love to direct this myself. And then we said to Michael, oh, Michael, you know, Tim Burton.
Michael was great about it, though.
Yeah, he was fantastic. And he stepped aside. And so Michael's terms, which were great, because they were sort of terms to kind of force Tim's hand, were if it's Tim's next movie, he gets the script. If it's not Tim's next movie, then the script would revert to Michael. And then Tim was like, okay, it's my next movie. And the ticking clock on us. Yeah. Tim was about to direct a movie called Mary Riley. So it was our job to blow up Mary Riley.
And he had been
prepping this movie for a year, and with like the costumes and the castles and all that, and the casting. And he had 6 weeks before the studio was going to force him to sign a pay-or-play deal. And so we had 6 weeks to give him a script that would be so cool that he would throw away this other movie he'd been working on for a year. And so we wrote it. We couldn't go over that deadline. So we had 6 weeks. We turned it on a Friday, and he called us Sunday night, and he said, I read it. It's my next movie, and I have no notes.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
It was crazy.
I think he was worried that, like, you know, that it'd be filtered through the development system, and all of a sudden people would be asking, like, oh, can Ed make a better movie at the end, or learn a lesson, or something, and he just liked it for what it was, and he wanted to just make it Ed Wood style.
Was Landau in mind from the beginning? Was it?
He was not in mind from us when we were writing. A lot of times people ask us that kind of question about the biopics, and we tend to think of the real people. But I think Tim latched on to Landau really quickly because he liked the way Landau had that kind of crazy career where he worked with Alfred Hitchcock, but then he also was in, you know, the Harlem Globetrotters on Gilligan's
yes.
Island.
Yes.
So he was like, this guy kind of has wild highs and wild lows, and so he could identify with...
He knows what it's like.
And at that point, Lando was on a total roll. That was coming right off of Crimes and Misdemeanors and Tucker, and so, like, he was firing on cylinders.
Although we interviewed Bela Lugosi Jr.
You did?
Yes!
He took exception to the fact that you had his father using profanity.
Yes.
He said, my father did not.
But other than that, was he okay with the movie?
Yes, I think he liked it.
I think he did, and he did like when Martin Landau accepted the Academy Award, and he said in an interview that he was getting the award for Bela Lugosi. Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's the thing. It's like we've heard a bunch of times that that Bela Jr. wasn't really that happy with it, and I don't take it's when you're making a movie about someone's father, they have different memories of their dad. You know, and maybe Bela didn't swear. You know, I don't want to. You know, it's just we were trying to make a loving tribute to Bela. I think Bela comes off great in that movie. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's a reason why Landau won the Oscar for it. We would describe the movie as Ed and Bela a love story. But I think Bela Jr. always said, like, why isn't someone making a movie about the good things about my father's life?
Wouldn't be a movie,
right? Exactly.
Why aren't they making a movie about the Dracula days?
Yeah.
when we were living in the big house.
Yeah.
Why are we making about when he's destitute and he's hitting up kids to drive him to the supermarket?
Right.
He doesn't have a car.
Because all of Bela Jr.'s life, this Ed Wood guy was some creepy guy who came in at the end and was a drunk.
He told us halfway through the interview, "Listen, I didn't know my dad all that well. I mean, his father died when he was." Young.
Yeah. 16 or 17.
Yeah, he's a lawyer. Yeah.
Called the undead.
Gilbert.
I brought it up because, I mean, that he would make a great movie because it's the idea of a guy with the name Bela Lugosi Jr.
That's a great name.
And on top of it, he's a lawyer.
Right. For dead people.
Yes.
Gilbert,
yes.
Gilbert, yes. Gilbert, yes. Well, we always joke that
I represent the dead.
We always say it would be great to be in court. It's like, who's your lawyer? I am Bela Lugosi Jr.
Yes.
Your Honor. May I approach the bench?
Our mutual friend, Drew Friedman.
I represent a corpse.
Is here in the room, and he gave me a question about the making of Ed Wood.
Okay.
Which members of the Ed Wood Stock Company did you guys have to deal with?
Oh.
In what sense?
No, who are in the movie. Like
the real life people.
We dealt with, like, the real Conrad Brooks and the real Paul Marco.
Oh, Paul Marco was a kick.
Yeah.
Paul Marco. Did you ever get to meet him?
No.
I rode a train cross country with Paul Marco.
Why is that?
Oh, wow. You were flying for a while.
You hopped a freight with Paul Marco? It's like,
sad story.
Covered with coal.
Emperor of the North Pole kind of thing?
Hey. A little bit like an old movie.
Yes. To be trapped.
Smokey, jump with me.
Oh, dear.
A scary character.
But he was a lunatic. He was very enthusiastic. Paul Marco was the founder and president of the Paul Marco fan club.
Yes.
Kelton the Cop.
Kelton the Cop. And if you ever see any of the memorabilia, I'm sure you can buy it on eBay for a nickel. He would always identify himself as Kelton, then quotation marks, the Cop, close quotation marks, which I couldn't figure out. He was insistent that Drew will back me on that one. That was the way to frame it. And so Paul Marco, once the Ed Wood movie started like showing up again in revival houses, he would go around Hollywood in his cop uniform and sort of try to crash events and then kind of just wait for the crowds to circle him.
My favorite Paul memory of the shoot was that, you know, actors have trailers. And Paul was brought in to just be like an extra.
It'd be a cameo.
He had one little line.
Yeah.
But he got there and he's looking around and he saw a trailer that had the name Paul Marco on it, but it was for the actor who was playing Paul Marco in the film.
The actor,
Paul thought that was his trailer. So Paul basically gets in there, takes off his shoes, starts eating all the food.
He starts throwing all the clothes out of the closet.
And so then Max comes up and like, oh, wait a second, the real Paul Marco's the man. Like, what can you do? Just let him have it for today.
Oh, and I prefer the story when they start fighting over it, which is like, I'm Paul Marco. No, I'm Paul Marco. And then Conrad Brooks was sort of the other Ed old-timer who we gave a cameo. And for the sake of screenwriting shorthand, we teamed them up in the movie.
Right.
And
it's kind of like they were really good pals.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. They became just like the Bowery Boys sidekicks. Like, hey, we need someone to go carry the wood over there. Okay.
Chief,
open it. So they were those guys, and it kind of made them both crazy that we were turning them into a team because they weren't. So they got very competitive.
It'd be like we're making a bio of us, and all of a sudden you and Michael Richards were hanging out on Problem
Shop. Oh, yes.
Two guys that just hang out.
Yeah, so
That'll happen one day.
So Conrad was much more low maintenance than Paul. So Conrad was an easy cameo. Paul heard about this. Paul wanted a cameo too, and I went to Tim and the producer saying we gotta put Paul on screen, and they were all scared of him because Paul was a nuisance. But I just said you just gotta find him a line. So we found him a line, and he was a security guard in the scene where they're stealing the octopus, and he's like, hey, what are you kids doing in there? He's that guy, and when you edit a movie, you have a long cut, and then you cut stuff out and shorten it. Paul's line got cut out. So then he was really unhappy because Conrad's line got left in.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we were always hearing about that.
And what memories do you have of Jeffrey Jones?
Very pleasant.
Yeah.
I'm not even going to take the bait there.
That is bait. Be careful.
Exactly. A fine gentleman.
He was quite dapper.
Exactly.
Now, can I just throw in something that has nothing to do
with Jeffrey Jones?
With Jeffrey Jones or anything we've been discussing. Mm-hmm. Drew Friedman.
Yes,
here in the room.
Yeah. Just told me that Clark Gable and Andy Devine used to fuck each other in the ass.
at the same time.
I think Gable fucked Andy Devine. They didn't fuck each other. Andy was the bottom.
Maybe they talked.
We can cut this part out, guys.
Okay, we'll get back to your career. Although I'd much rather talk about Clark Gable fucking Andy Devine than yes. Now, also, you wanted to make a remake or a sequel to It's a Mad, 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 Mad World.
How do you know that?
Wow.
Yeah.
We know stuff. We have a.
I don't know how much we really wanted to do that.
It was more of a remake we were intrigued by. And we met with Stanley Kramer's widow, who's a very nice lady. Mm-hmm. But she was insistent. We just had a bizarre argument with this old lady. Insisting it had to be a sequel, not a remake.
Right.
And that we had to grab everyone who was still alive.
Oh!
And it was just, so depressing, because it's like we had seen Sid Caesar going to his doctor's office in Beverly Hills.
Oh!
You know, and poor Jonathan Winters, who was, right. You know...
Marvin Kaplan. I mean, there's nobody who's still alive. I mean, four or five people.
They're all hobbling right now. I mean, Mickey right. Rooney was...
Steve Durante. They all died right within the first 10 minutes, and they're sharing it. It's like Murder on the Orient Express. They're sharing a secret.
Now, and
we couldn't win her over to our side.
Exactly.
And both Frank and I agree that it's funny. It's like I definitely advise people to see Mad Mad World. But neither one of us thought it was funny.
I'm with you. Mad 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 World, when I was growing up, I did not think it was funny at all. It's definitely come... It had a horrible reputation.
Yeah.
And nowadays, it maybe it's like Problem Child. Nowadays, it has a perfect reputation. It really... I think it's just held up in a big way. Like, when I do things for the American Cinematheque, whenever they run, it's a Mad 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 World. The place is packed.
Strange.
People are laughing their heads off. And it's a great time.
I would disagree. I don't think its reputation has ever changed. It's always been a movie that didn't really work. But it has enough great set pieces in it that people have a good time. And, I mean, there's hours and hours and hours of that movie. So if
you're, Merman's funny in it.
Yeah, if you're Phil Silver's. Yeah, I mean, there's great
Caesar's
stuff.
Caesar's funny.
But I think it's Buddy Hackett.
Yeah. Buddy Hackett's funny.
They're all funny.
And Jonathan Winters.
Yeah, that's
is
a great scene.
So great in that movie. And so even if you're bored out of your mind during some 10 or 15 minute set piece that won't end, there's a good one come around the corner. I mean, I'm very fond of the movie. The movie doesn't work, but I do love the movie. And every time I've ever seen it again, particularly in a theater, I'm always glad I went.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. I mean, don't think of him as Stanley Kramer as a comedy director. I mean, I think of the Defiant Ones in Judgment at Nuremberg. I mean, he's a pretty serious guy.
Here's a
Hair with the Wind.
A good piece of trivia for people out there. For next time people watch the movie, I just learned this. Spencer Tracy was really sick when they were shooting the movie. I guess he's coming to dinner after this.
Yeah. Yes.
But he couldn't move. And so anytime he had to move, it's a stuntman wearing a rubber Spencer Tracy mask.
Oh, jeez.
And so someone was telling me, if you watch the scenes where he grabs the money, he's running up the stairs, it's a guy with his face on.
Oh, my God.
So that's kind of cool. I haven't checked this out, but it's a cool thing because they made up masks for all the cast, and so like all the scenes like where they're up on the ladder and they're moving around.
Yeah,
there's a guy actually wearing a Rochester mask and another mask.
Oh, Peter Falk mask.
Peter Falk mask. No, sorry, I misspoke. Ethel Merman wasn't on the ladder. She's down below screaming.
Yeah. Scott went to Rochester's grave recently.
Did you?
Yes, I did. Okay.
What did it say on there? Anything interesting?
Did
it say yes, Mr. Benny?
while you're talking, I'll pull up the picture.
Well,
you can look at it.
Speaking of projects that didn't happen, we have to ask you about the Marx Brothers project.
The Marx Brothers project...
Who wants to pay for that movie?
Yeah.
Who will make it for us?
The problem with the Marx Brothers movie is it's a fine script, but it broke our rules. We sort of are the kings of the anti-biopic. We make movies about fringe pop culture characters, and the Marx Brothers was sort of a great man bio. It broke our rules, and that was 3 hours long. It was a movie... I mean, basically, the Marx Brothers deserve a biography, mm-hmm. and I think... Our particular magic as screenwriters is to capture people who don't. You know, people that said that, so it gives them the world can look at people in a different light. Where the Marx Brothers are just, you know, Richard Attenborough could make a Marx Brothers movie.
And it's like the Marx Brothers were successful.
Correct.
And were respected.
Right, and they kept on getting more successful and more successful.
Yeah.
I mean, the Groucho conquered every medium he was in.
Okay, they had their ups and downs. I mean, surprisingly, it was a big plot point in the script. Duck Soup was a debacle.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
And they lost their contract at Paramount, and they couldn't get work for 2 years. And at that point, Zeppo said, I'm leaving the act because there was no income coming in.
He was reluctant to begin with, Zeppo, though, wasn't he?
Oh, sure.
Well, Zeppo got
forced into the straight man part by Mom because Gummo was the straight man initially because, you know, back in the vaudeville day, you had to have each of the types. And so, you know, you had the ethnic, you had the dummy, you had the professor, and then you had the good-looking young tenor. And those are the four brothers, all each playing a vaudeville type. And after a certain point, Gummo just got fed up with it because he didn't think he was a particularly entertaining person, and no one's giving him jokes anyway. And so he basically said, "I'd rather enlist in World War I than being on stage." And so Gummo leaves the act, and so brothers call their mother in a panic, saying, "We don't have Gummo." And so Mom goes and she springs Zeppo out of juvenile hall,
right,
saying, "Put on your shoes, you're in the act now." And then she basically ships him off. And he says, Ma, I don't want to be in the act. Shut up. We need a fourth. And so Zeppo got forced in as a replacement into a thankless part.
Right.
And Zeppo, everyone always said, was a funny guy. And there's the great story.
The appendicitis.
When Groucho got appendicitis and then they didn't have an understudy and the producer's panicking saying, what do we do? And Zeppo says, I know all the lines. And they're all like, oh, shit, well, it's that or we don't go on tonight. And Zeppo put on the grease paint and he killed. And the audience didn't know it wasn't Groucho.
Right.
And then word got back to Groucho in the hospital, and he throws on the gown, and he runs back to the theater. And they go, what are you doing here? He says, I got better.
Yeah, I got well sooner, I think was our version of the joke. Because at that point, it's like, I think Groucho was worried that the Marx Brothers could be like the Blue Man Group. You know, I didn't even put the mustache on and just do my act. So Groucho was going to protect that. Nowadays, he'd be like, hey, we can be playing in 10 cities at the same time. We'd be like Gallagher 2.
And real quick, is there a city?
Can we talk about Gallagher 2?
Gallagher 2.
I would love to talk about Gallagher
2. Yes!
I would make a Gallagher 2 movie.
Right. Yeah, I absolutely. I've been saying for years somebody ought to make a movie about that, because that is insane.
Yes. We should tell a story so people know what we're talking about.
Well, Gallagher, also disrespected.
I don't know why.
I think even we would have a hard time being non-judgmental.
Yeah.
Gallagher.
And Gallagher used to smash his watermelon.
Used to?
Yes. Oh, he still dies.
It's a living.
And then his brother, who looks just like him, wanted to be Gallagher. And he said, no, you'll be Gallagher too. And it's an agreement that you don't smash a watermelon. And then he started smashing the watermelon and started to get all the jobs Gallagher would have taken, but for cheaper.
It's a
betrayal story.
I have a different understanding of the story. but this is Rashomon. We all bring ourselves to the tale. My understanding of Gallagher 2 is that... And
this is the first time I've ever heard Rashomon and Gallagher in the same sentence.
But I'll protect this all and say what I've heard allegedly happened.
Yes, none of this could be true. So Gallagher
that Gallagher allegedly got greedy, and he looked at his brother. He says, and he figured out that Gilbert, you play the circuit, and you know there's like the A theaters and there's the B theaters,
yes,
and there's the colleges and the big towns. There's colleges and the small towns, and the big towns can pay more for one night. And he figured out he'd send Dummy younger brother out on the smaller circuit.
Yeah, to the sticks.
To the sticks.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But they can't pay.
This is our interpretation. We could be totally wrong.
This is
100% wrong.
I didn't research this before I came in here tonight.
Yes.
Right. You know, maybe they can't pay $10,000 a night. They can pay $2,000 a night. But money's
money. For $2,000, you get Gallagher 2.
Yeah.
And you know, and then a big Gallagher, and then in parentheses a very small two, you know, on the poster.
Yeah.
And then people started not knowing the difference, and then Gallagher too started getting greedy and tried to book himself
in
into
the bigger places,
town,
right. And he worked cheaper than his brother.
And it got ugly.
Right.
And then there's the completely bananas sidebar, which would be sort of like a third act subplot if we were to ever write this. Which is that Gallagher completely horrors out the whole act in every direction, where he decides to start playing Spanish language theaters.
Yes.
With mariachis and like Hispanic ladies in white flowered dresses, and I'm not making this up. He learns the act phonetically.
Yes.
He doesn't speak Spanish.
Wow.
And so he can come out and say, Buenos dias.
Señores y señoritas. Soy Gallagher.
Yeah.
And he was playing like down like the Spanish theaters on Broadway in LA. All Spanish.
Unreal.
And why it would be perfect for the two of you is they did take it to court.
Yes.
Gallagher 1 and Gallagher 2.
I don't remember how it ended.
I think everyone wound up on Gallagher 2's side.
Even Mom.
I think you're right.
I think your mom. I think
you're
mom.
Right. Yes. The family of Gallagher 2.
You are correct. Wow, I forgot about that.
Oh, no.
His own family turned on
But it was all my idea, Mom.
Real quick, and we'll get on to Big Eyes, and then we can know you guys can go. Is there a Michael Jackson story that Drew tells us? There's a surreal story about meeting Michael Jackson?
Oh, we did meet Michael Jackson.
That was a hell of an afternoon.
I thought you were saying, should we write to Michael Jackson? Is there a Michael
that
Jackson
too.
Story?
After the Gallagher project.
No, we, for a very brief time, we controlled...
Larry.
What, forever?
Sid and Marty Krupp were in our lives for years.
Yeah, we love Sid and Marty Krupp. They really are two... great guys, and they're one of our... They're our kind of guys. We love
you,
funny old
You should
business.
Get them on your show.
Oh.
They are, my God, they'd be amazing.
They are so funny.
But they're very different. Like you know, Sid is the creative, trippy kind of guy, and Marty's the businessman. You know, and... but we partnered up with them for a while, and we set up HR Puffin stuff as a movie a bunch of different places.
We kept selling that project.
Right. And we set it up one time at 20th Century Fox... And for some reason, all of a sudden, the deal started not being able to close. And we were like, for some reason, the Crofts were not going to close the deal with them. And we're like, what's going on? Don't worry. Don't worry. We got something better. And it turned out that we got MJ. We got MJ. And so
that's Larry's impression of Marty.
Yes, Marty. Oh.
Marty. Marty talks like this.
And Sid talks like this. And so Marty's saying... We're cooking up a big deal with MJ and the richest black man in Detroit.
Right.
what does that mean?
Right.
So, he's gonna open an MJ amusement park.
Right.
He made all his money in parking lots.
Right.
And he believes in MJ.
Right.
And so we got to walk away from Fox because this is bigger.
Right.
And we're saying, Marty, come on, Fox just wants to make things. No. So eventually, we thought, this cannot be real. And then Sid had some connection to Michael Jackson, and God bless him. Sid calls one day saying, okay, can you boys be at this recording studio in Encino at 3 o'clock? And we go, sure. Why? MJ's going to be there. And we got to this recording studio, and there's Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
And he had his son, Prince, who was a toddler. At the time, so this is a long time ago, and he was sort of playing with this very white little boy. and then we sort of spent the rest of the afternoon with Michael talking about how we weren't quite sure why we were there. It turned out he wanted to direct Puffin Stuff, star in Puffin Stuff, and write the music for Puffin Stuff.
Yeah,
wow. It was kind of crazy.
Yeah, but the highlight of the day was he actually. He was talking about Willy Wonka. I wanted to be like Willy Wonka.
It's gotta be like Willy Wonka.
And he started singing Pure Imagination to us. And it was just singing it to us.
He was singing it a cappella.
It was unbelievable. So
unreal.
And he had no nose. He literally had just a little nail.
And
there, that was
a clitoris, as Mario Cantone refers to it.
And
wow.
I remember when I was little, I would go with my mother into Woolworth. And they would have the Velvet Elvis paintings, the dogs playing poker, and the Jesus blinking eyes, 3D Jesus on a cross, bleeding and blinking eyes. And that's where I became familiar with those Keane paintings.
Yeah. Well, no, Walter Keane was sort of the guy who invented the mass marketing of art. I mean, they were not accepted in regular art circles, and so he sort of figured this weird end run around the whole enterprise, where he would build his own gallery, put on his own coffee table book, and he kept on, you know, basically, not that many people were really buying the prints. I mean, they were buying the original paintings, so he figured a way to make them prints and make them cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and cheaper until they basically were posters, and as posters, he could sell them anywhere, and so he sort of took art to the common man, and he figured out that art critics didn't matter. If he could get a picture of him with Joan Crawford or Natalie Wood or Kim Novak, you know, holding one of the paintings, or get someone, you know, to go on the Tonight Show to sort of, you know, to tell the world what a great, like Jack Parr said that you know, one of Walter's paintings was one of the greatest works of art of all time. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, they were making money hand over fist. They would sell pictures and postcards and posters, and he was insanely successful. But that's not even really, that's only part of our story for the movie Big Eyes, because the behind the scenes, what was going on was Walter couldn't paint at all. And his wife was sort of locked up in their attic, and she was the artist, and she was the one doing all the work, and he was putting his name on it. And so the movie is sort of about this woman learning kind of to stand up for herself.
And like, she lost all her friends.
Yes,
Yeah, well, Walter didn't want anyone hanging around the house, because they might go into the painting room, and then he didn't want Margaret going out to lunch with people because they might say, "What have you been up to lately?" "Oh, I paint day and night."
Exactly.
Uh-huh. So he intentionally isolated Margaret from everybody. So really, all she had was her daughter and the paints.
Yeah, and she was also a woman who just, you know, struggled with she had her own dignity, and so she didn't feel good about lying. So that she sort of pulled herself away from her friends and other people. So,
and how did he convince? Was he overpowering? And
he was overpowering, but also he's an odd villain for a movie because he's so successful. Everything he says is becomes true.
Sure,
you know what I mean?
It's like different talents.
Yeah,
he's
yeah. It was one of those things where, like, yes, you know, when she first agreed, you know, and he sort of bullied her to let him put the name on it, and they were selling in the basement of the Hungry Eye nightclub. It was just like art they were selling. You know, maybe we can make rent this month by selling these paintings. But he took this art and he turned it into the biggest selling art in America. So all of a sudden now they had a gigantic house. They had a college fund for the daughter. They, you know, and so he made her seem like she was ridiculous for complaining. So who cares whose name's on the painting? You know, why can't you be happy, woman? And so she was in this weird existential dilemma, right. Of like, this is my art, these are my feelings on this thing, but you're taking all the credit and I'm supposed to be happy about it.
And we should say this is a true labor of love for you guys. You started the project in 2003.
Correct.
Yes.
That's when you got deep into the research, you met Margaret Keane, you promised her that one day this movie was going to see the light of day,
yeah.
And 11 years later, many false starts.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were going to direct it ourselves, and we kept casting it and financing it and getting a crew, and then we would go and prep it in Portland or Salt Lake City or New Orleans or Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Yeah.
And each one of these versions we would put a few months into, and no one ever paid us for 10 years. So it was all out of pocket, and then it would collapse.
Yeah, maybe that time that we cast Gilbert as Walter Keane, that seemed to really make it collapse a little quicker.
Gilbert and Reese were the
exactly.
I
shut up, honey. Who cares whose name's on it?
I did a day's work in Case of Rain on on A Million Ways to Die in the West.
Okay.
And Amanda Seyfried already has big eyes.
Yes, very big eyes.
So they did a quick gag in the movie for a second, where she turns around, she has the keen eyes.
Oh, that's funny.
They superimpose
them. Is that in the movie?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I saw the movie and I don't remember that.
What?
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, everybody, it falls into that thing where there's this pop culture thing that Scott and I love, where absolutely everybody knows the paintings and that look, whether it's from, you know, the real thing or Puss in Boots and Shrek or whatever. But no one knows the story. You know, some people who see the movie say, God, I didn't know any of that. You're not really supposed to know any of it. You know, because when they were really successful, it was Walter Keane. Walter Keane was the guy totally in charge, and Margaret Keane claiming the rights to the paintings happened a couple years later, and that sort of happened off the front page of the paper. And so it was like, you know, if it was reported at all, it was sort of like, those two people who make paintings that we don't really like anymore, they're fighting. So, you know.
I saw the picture last night. It's great.
Thank you.
Thank you. You guys must be very gratified.
We're very, very. It's playing so well with audiences, and you know, and Tim did such an amazing job with the movie, and you know, Amy Adams is,
yeah,
you know,
her cast is wonderful.
It's a very intriguing part because she she's playing a very quiet woman,
sure,
and so she has to do so much with just like expression, just like it's like a silent movie performance.
And the story's through her eyes. So
totally through her eyes.
Yeah, but Walter is the showboat, so he gets all the talking.
Right.
It was fun.
That's why we thought Gilbert would be good in that part.
He just won't shut up.
And now we have to let the two of you go, because you're going to another...
Going to Marma.
Our premiere.
Yes,
premiere.
The premiere of Big Eyes, which I haven't seen yet, but sounds fascinating.
Opens on Christmas.
I know the story. Yeah. And it's a fascinating story. And so hi, I'm Gilbert Gottfried. This is Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast. I'm here with my co-host, Frank Santopadre, and we've been talking to Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski, who have said out in, they've said this several times, that after working with Gilbert Gottfried on Problem Child, everything was downhill from there. So, and they're on their way to see their latest film, Big Eyes.
We hardly scratched the surface with these guys. I hope we didn't get to Larry Flint and we didn't get to Mars Attacks or Andy Kaufman, so we'll do a part two. If you guys are amenable.
And we didn't get
to
Ford Fairlane, which we were on the set all the time when we were making Ford Fairlane.
I saw it last week.
Yes.
It played last week at the Cinematheque in Los Angeles.
Yes.
The crowd ate it up.
Oh, my God.
And Dice was there, and our friend Dan Waters, who wrote the script, and I enjoyed watching you get electrocuted.
Everyone did. And we didn't talk about Sammy Petrillo.
Oh, no! Oh, no!
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, we got to start the whole show over.
we'll do a part two with you guys.
Oh, no. There has to be.
Okay.
Thank you, guys.
This is, we could have gone another 5 hours. So, we've been talking to Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski, creators of Problem Child 1 and 2, and their current film opens on Christmas Day, Big Eyes.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yay.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger, I've been friends with her for 10 years, one of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny. And I love you.
A few days ago, Brooke Tudeen posted an inspirational quote on her wall that got 17 likes and 3 comments. Thumbs up, Brooke. Geico also wants to make a comment. In just 15 minutes, you could save hundreds of dollars on your car insurance by switching to Geico. And nothing says inspiration better than saving money. Well, except for those posters that say things like teamwork, excellence, and make it happen. Hashtag keep climbing. Hashtag savings.
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.